From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. When I Was Dead by Vincent O'Sullivan. And yet my heart will not confess he owes the malady that doth my life besiege. All's well that ends well. That was the worst of Ravenel Hall. The passages were long and gloomy, the rooms were musty and dull. Even the pictures were somber and their subjects dire. On an autumn evening, when the wind soughed and ailed through the trees in the park, and the dead leaves whistled and chattered, while the rain clamored at the windows, small wonder that folks with gentle nerves went astraying in their wits. An acute nervous system is a grievous burden on the deck of a yacht under sunlit skies. At Ravenel, the chain of nerves was prone to clash and jangle a funeral march. Nerves must be pampered in a tea-drinking community, and the ghost that your grandfather, with a skinful of port, could face and never tremble, sets you in your sobriety sweating and shivering, or becoming scared, poor ghost, of your bulged eyes and dropping jaw. He quenches expectation by not appearing at all. So I am left to conclude that it was tea which made my acquaintance afraid to stay at Ravenel. Even Wilvern gave over, and as he is in the guards and a polo player, his nerves ought to be strong enough. On the night before he went, I was explaining to him my theory that if you place some drops of human blood near you and then concentrate your thoughts, you will after a while see before you a man or woman who will stay with you during long hours of the night, and even meet you at unexpected places during the day. I was explaining this theory, I repeat, when he interrupted me with words senseless enough, which sent me fencing and paring strangers on my guard. "I say, Alistair, my dear chap," he began, "you ought to get out of this place and go up to town and knock about a bit. You really ought, you know." "Yes," I replied. "And get poisoned at the hotels by bad food, and at the clubs by bad talk, I suppose. No, thank you. And let me say that your care for my health enervates me." "Well, you can do as you like," says he, rapping with his feet on the floor. "I'm hanged if I stay here after tomorrow. I'll be staring mad if I do." He was my last visitor. Some weeks after his departure, I was sitting in the library with my drops of blood by me. I had got my theory nearly perfect by this time, but there was one difficulty. The figure which I had ever before me was the figure of an old woman, with her hair divided in the middle, and her hair fell to her shoulders, white on one side and black on the other. She as a very complete old woman, but alas, she was eyeless, and when I tried to construct the eyes, she would shrivel and rot in my sight. But tonight, I was thinking, thinking as I had never thought before, and the eyes were just creeping into the head when I heard a terrible crash outside as if some heavy substance had fallen. Of a sudden the door was flung open and two maidservants entered. They glanced at the rug under my chair, and at that they turned a sick white, cried on God, and huddled out. "How dare you enter the library in this manner?" I demanded sternly. No answer came back from them, so I started in pursuit. I found all the servants in the house gathered in a knot at the end of the passage. "Mrs. Pebble," I said smartly to the housekeeper, "I want those two women discharged tomorrow. It's an outrage. You ought to be more careful." But she was not attending to me. Her face was distorted with terror. "Oh dear, oh dear," she went. "We had better all go to the library together," says she to the others. "Am I master of my own house, Mrs. Pebble?" I inquired, bringing my knuckles down with a bang on the table. None of them seemed to see me or hear me. I might as well have been shrieking in a desert. I followed them down the passage, and forbade them to enter the library. But they trooped past me, and stood with a clutter round the hearthrug. Then three or four of them began dragging and lifting, as if they were lifting a helpless body, and stumbled with their imaginary burden over to a sofa. Old Soames, the butler, stood near. "Poor young gentleman," he said with a sob. "I've known him since he was a baby. And to think of him being dead like this, and so young, too!" I crossed the room. "What's all this, Soames?" I cried, shaking him roughly by the shoulder. "I'm not dead. I'm here, here!" As he did not stir, I got a little scared. "Soames, old friend," I called, "don't you know me? Don't you know the little boy you used to play with? Say I'm not dead. Soames, please! Soames!" He stooped down and kissed the sofa. "I think one of the men ought to ride over to the village for the doctor, Mr. Soames," says Mrs. Pebble, and he shuffled out to give the order. Now this doctor was an ignorant dog, whom I had been forced to exclude from the house because he went about proclaiming his belief in a saving God, at the same time they proclaimed himself a man of science. He, I was resolved, should never cross my threshold, and I followed Mrs. Pebble through the house, screaming out prohibition. But I did not catch even a groan from her, not a nod of the head, nor a cast of the eye to show that she had heard. I met the doctor at the door of the library. "Well," I sneered, throwing my hand in his face, "have you come to teach me some new prayers?" He brushed by me, as if he had not felt the blow, and knelt down by the sofa. "Rupture of a vessel in the brain, I think," he says to Soames and Mrs. Pebble after a short moment. "He has been dead some hours. Poor fellow. You had better telegraph for his sister, and I will send up the undertaker to arrange the body." "You liar," I yelled. "You whining liar. How have you the insolence to tell my servants that I am dead, when you see me here face to face?" He was far in the passage, with Soames and Mrs. Pebble at his heels, ere I had ended, and not one of the three turned around. All that night I sat in the library. Strangely enough, I had no wish to sleep, nor during the time that followed had I any craving to eat. In the morning the men came, and although I ordered them out, they proceeded to minister about something I could not see. So all day I stayed in the library or wandered about the house, and at night the men came again bringing with them a coffin. Then, in my humor, thinking it shame that so fine a coffin should be empty, I lay the night in it and slept a soft, dreamless sleep, the softest sleep I ever slept. And when the men came the next day, I rested still, and the undertaker shaved me, a strange valet. On the evening after that, I was coming downstairs when I noticed some luggage in the hall, and so learned that my sister had arrived. I had not seen this woman since her marriage, and I loathed her more than I loathed any creature in this ill-organized world. She was very beautiful, I think, tall and dark and straight as a ramrod, and she had an unruly passion for scandal and dress. I suppose the reason I disliked her so intensely was that she had a habit of making one aware of her presence when she was several yards off. At 9:30, my sister came down to the library in a very charming wrap, and I soon found that she was insensible to my presence as the others. I trembled with rage to see her kneel down by the coffin, my coffin. But when she bent over to kiss the pillow, I threw away control. A knife which had been used to cut string was lying upon a table. I seized it and drove it into her neck. She fled from the room screaming. "Come, come," she cried, her voice quivering with anguish. "The corpse is bleeding from the nose." Then I cursed her. On the evening of the third day, there was a heavy fall of snow. About 11:00, I observed that the house was filled with blacks and mutes and folks of the county, who came for the obsequies. I went into the library and sat still and waited. Soon came the men, and they closed the lid of the coffin and bore it out on their shoulders. And yet I sat feeling rather sadly that something of mine had been taken away. I could not quite think what. For half an hour, perhaps, dreaming. And then I glided to the hall door. There was no trace left of the funeral. But after a while I sighted a black thread winding slowly across the white plain. "I'm not dead," I moaned. and rubbed my face in the pure snow and tossed it on my neck and hair. Sweet God, I'm not dead. The Business of Madame Jean by Vincent O'Sullivan. How we all stared. How frightened we all were. How we passed opinions on that morning when Gustave Herbout was found swinging by the neck from the ceiling of his bedroom. The whole Faubourg, even the ancient folk, who had not felt the street under them for years, turned out and stood gaping at the house with amazement and loud conjecture. For why should Gustave Herbout, of all men, take to the rope? Only last week he had inherited all the money of his aunt, Madame Jean, together with her house and the shop with the 5 assistants, and life looked fair enough for him. No, clearly it was not wise of Gustave to hang himself. Besides, his aunt's death had happened at a time when Gustave was in sore straits for money. To be sure, he had a salary from the bank in which he worked. But what is a mere salary to one who, like Gustave, threw off the clerkly habit when working hours are over to assume the dress and lounge of the accustomed boulevardier, while he would relate to obsequious friends vague but satisfactory stories of a Russian prince who was his uncle, and of an extremely rich English lady to whose death he looked forward with hope. Alas, with a clerk's salary, one cannot make much of a figure in Paris. It took all of that and more to maintain the renown he had gained amongst his acquaintance of having to his own a certain little lady with yellow hair who danced divinely. So he was forced to depend on the presents which Madame Jean gave him from time to time. And for those presents, he had to pay his aunt a most sedulous and irksome attention. At times, when he was almost sick from his craving for the boulevard, the café, the theater, he would have to repair, as the day grew to an end, to our Faubourg and the house behind the shop, where he would sit to an old-fashioned supper with his aunt and listen with a sort of dull impatience while she asked him where he had last been at confession and told him long dreary stories of his dead father and mother. Punctually at 9 o'clock, the deaf servant, who was the only person besides Madame Jean that lived in the house, would let in the fat old priest who came for his game of dominoes and betake herself to bed. Then the dominoes would begin, and with them the old man's prattle, which Gustave knew so well, about his daily work, about the usefulness of all things here on earth, and the happiness and glory of the kingdom of heaven. And, of course, our boulevardier noticed, with the usual cheap sneer of the modern, that whilst the priest talked of the kingdom of heaven, he yet showed the greatest anxiety if he had symptoms of a cold or any other pretty malady. However, Gustave would sit there with a hypocrite's grin and inwardly raging till the clock chimed 11. At that hour, Madame Jean would rise, and if she was pleased with her nephew, would go over to her writing desk and give him, with a rather pretty air of concealment from the priest, perhaps 50 or 100 francs. Whereupon Gustave would bid her a manifestly affectionate good night and depart in the company of the priest. As soon as he could get rid of the priest, he would hasten to his favorite café to discover that all the people were seeing had long since grown tired of waiting and had departed on their own affairs. The money, indeed, was a kind of consolation, but then there were nights when he did not get a sou. Ah, they amused themselves in Paris, but not in this way. This is not amusing. One cannot live a proper life upon a salary and an occasional gift of 50 or 100 francs. And it is not entertaining to tell men that your uncle, the prince at Moscow, is in a sorry case, and even now lies a-dying, or that the rich English lady is in the grip of a vile consumption, and is momently expected to succumb. If these men only shove up their shoulders, wink at one another, and continue to present their bills. Further, the little mademoiselle with yellow hair had lately shown signs of a very pretty temper, because her usual flowers and bonbons were not apparent. So, since things were coming to this dismal pass, Gustave fell to attending the race meetings at Chantilly. During the first week, Gustave won largely, for that is sometimes the way with ignorant men. During that week, too, the little mademoiselle was charming, for she had her bouquets and boxes of bonbons. But the next week, Gustave lost heavily, for that is very often the way with ignorant men, and he was thrown into the blackest despair, when one night at a place where he used to sup, Mademoiselle took the arm of a great fellow, whom he much suspected to be a German, and tossed him a scornful nod as she went off. On the evening after this happened, he was standing between 5 and 6 o'clock in the Place de la Madeleine, blowing on his fingers and trying to plan his next move, when he heard his name called by a familiar voice, and turned to face his aunt's advisor, the priest. "Ah, Gustave, my friend, I have just been to see a colleague of mine here," cried the old man, pointing to the great church. "And are you going to your good aunt tonight?" he added with a look at Gustave's neat dress. Gustave was in a flame that the priest should have detected him in his gay clothes, for he always made a point of appearing at Madame Jean's, clad staidly in black. But he answered pleasantly enough, "No, my father, I'm afraid I can't tonight. You see, I'm a little behind with my office work, and I have to stay at home and catch up." "Well, well," said the priest with half a sigh, "I suppose young men will always be the same. I myself can only be with her till 9 o'clock tonight, because I must see a sick parishioner. But let me give you one bit of advice, my friend," he went on, taking hold of a button on Gustave's coat. "Don't neglect your aunt, for mark my words, one day everything of Madame John's will be yours." And the omnibus he was waiting for, happening to swing by at that moment, he departed without another word. Gustave strolled along the Boulevard des Capuchins in a study. Yes, it was certain that the house and the shop, with the 5 assistants, would one day be his, for the priest knew all his aunt's affairs. But how soon would they be his? Madame Jean was now hardly 60. Her mother had lived to be 90. When she was 90, he would be? And meanwhile, what about the numerous bills? What, above all, about the little lady with yellow hair? He paused and struck his heel on the pavement with such force that 2 men passing nudged one another and smiled. Then he made certain purchases and set about wasting his time till 9 o'clock. It is curious to consider that although when he started out at 9 o'clock, Gustave was perfectly clear as to what he meant to do, yet he was chiefly troubled by the fear that the priest had told his aunt about his fine clothes. But when he had passed through the deserted Faubourg and had come to the house behind the shop, he found his aunt only very pleased to see him and a little surprised. So he sat with her and listened to her gentle homily story and told lies about himself and his manner of life till the clock struck 11. Then he rose, and Madame Jean rose too and went to a writing desk and opened a small drawer. "You have been very kind to a lonely old woman tonight, my Gustave," said Madame Jean, smiling. "How sweet of you to say that, dearest aunt," replied Gustave. He went over and passed his arm caressingly across her shoulders and stabbed her in the heart. For a full 5 minutes after the murder he stood still, as men often do in a great crisis, when they know that any movement means decisive action. Then he started, laid hold of his hat, and made for the door. But there the stinging knowledge of his crime came to him for the first time, and he turned back into the room. Madame Jean's bedroom candle was on a table. He lit it and passed through a door which led from the house into the shop. Crouching below the counters, covered with white sheets, lest a streak of light on the windows might attract the observation of some passenger, he proceeded to side entrance to the shop, unbarred and unlocked the door, and put the key in his pocket. Then, in the same crouching way, he returned to the room and started to ransack the small drawer. The notes he scattered about the floor, but 2 small bags of coins went into his pocket. Then he took the candle and dropped some wax on the face and hands and dress of the corpse. He spilt wax, too, over the carpet, and then he broke the candle and ground it under his foot. He even tore with long, nervous fingers at the dead woman's bodice until her breast lay exposed, and plucked out a handful of her hair, and threw it on the floor to stick to the wax. When all these things had been accomplished, he went to the house door and listened. The Faubourg is always very quiet about 12 o'clock, and a single footstep falls on the night with a great sound. He could not hear the least noise, so he darted out and ran lightly until he came to a turning. There he fell into a sauntering walk, lit a cigarette, and hailing a passing fiacre, directed the man to drive to the Pont Saint-Michel. At the bridge, he alighted, and noting that he was not eyed, he threw the key of the shop into the river. Then, assuming the swagger and assurance of a half-drunken man, he marched up the boulevard and entered the Café de Harcourt. The place was filled with the usual crowd of men and women of the Quarter Latin. Gustave looked around, and observing a young student with a flushed face who was talking eagerly about the rights of man, he sat down by him. It was his part to act quickly, so before the student had quite finished a sentence for his car, the murderer gave him the lie. The student, however, was not so ready for a fight as Gustave had supposed, and when he began to argue again, Gustave seized a glass full of brandy and water and threw the stuff in his face. Then indeed there was a row, till the gendarmes interfered and hailed Gustave to the station. At the police station, he bitterly lamented his misdeed, which he attributed to an extra glass of absinthe, and he begged the authorities to carry word of his plight to his good aunt, Madame Jean, in Alfaubourg. So to the house behind the shop they went, and there they found her, sitting with her breast hanging out, her poor head clotted with blood, and a knife in her heart. The next morning Gustave was set free. A man and a woman, two of the five assistants in the shop, had been charged with the murder. The woman had been severely reprimanded by Madame Jean on the day before, and the man was known to be the girl's paramour. It was the duty of the man to close at night all the entrances into the shop, save the main entrance, which was closed by Madame Jean and her deaf servant, and the police have formed a theory, worked out with the amazing zeal and skill which caused the Paris police so often to overreach themselves, that the man had failed to bolt one of the side doors, and had, by his subtlety, got possession of the key whereby he and his accomplice re-entered the place about midnight. Working on this theory, the police had woven a web round the two unfortunates with threads of steel, and there was little doubt that both of them would stretch their necks under the guillotine with full consent of press and public. At least this was Gustave's opinion, and Gustave's opinion now went for a great deal in the Faubourg. Of course, there were a few who murmured that it was a good thing poor Madame Jean had not lived to see her nephew arrested for a drunken brawler, but with full remembrance of who owned the shop and the house, which were most of us inclined to say after the priest, that if the brave Gustave had been with his aunt, a shocking affair could never have occurred. And indeed, what had we more inspiring the inconsolable grief he showed? Why, on the day of the funeral, when he heard the earth clatter down on the coffin lid and Père Lachaise, he even swooned to the ground and had to be carried out in the midst of the mourners. "Oh yes," quoth the gossips, "Gustave Herbout loved his aunt passing well." On the night after the funeral, Gustave was sitting alone before the fire in Madame Jean's room, smoking and making his plans. He thought that when all this wretched mock grief and pretense of decorum was over, he would again visit the cafes which he greatly savored, and the little mademoiselle with yellow hair would once more smile on him delicious smiles with a gleaming regard. Thus he was thinking when the clock on the mantelpiece tinkled 11, and at that moment a very singular thing happened. The door was suddenly opened, a girl came in and walked straight over to the writing desk, pulled out the small drawer, and then sat staring at the man by the fire. She was distinctly beautiful, although there was a certain old-fashionedness in her peculiar silken dress and the manner of wearing her hair. Not once did it occur to Gustave, as he gazed in terror, that he was gazing on a mortal woman. The doors were too well bolted to allow anyone from outside to enter, and besides, there was a strange baffling familiarity to the face and mien of the intruder. It might have been an hour as he sat there, and then, the signs becoming too horrible by a supreme effort of his wonderful courage, he rushed out of the room and upstairs to get his hat. There in his murdered aunt's bedroom, there, smiling at him from the wall, was a vivid presentiment of the dread vision that sat below, a portrait of Madame Jean as a girl. He fled into the street, and walked perhaps 2 miles, before he thought at all. When he did think, he found that he was drawn against his will back to the house to see it, if it was there, just as the police here believe a murderer is drawn to the morgue to view the body of his victim. Yes, the girl was there still, with her great reproachless eyes, throughout the solemn night, Gustav, haggard and mute, sat glaring at her. Towards dawn, he fell into an uneasy doze, and when he awoke with a scream, he found that the girl was gone. At noon the next day, Gustav, heartened by several glasses of brandy and cheered by the sunshine and the Champs-Élysées, endeavored to make light of the affair. He would gladly have arranged not to go back to the house, but then people would talk so much, and he could not afford to lose any custom out of the shop. Moreover, the whole matter was only a hallucination, the effect of jaded nerves. He dined well and went to see a musical comedy, and so contrived that he did not return to the house until after 2 o'clock. There was someone waiting for him, sitting at the desk with a small drawer open. Not the girl of last night, but a somewhat older woman, and the same reproachless eyes. So great was the fascination of those eyes, that although he left the house at once with an iron resolution not to go back, he found himself drawn under them again, and he sat through the night as he had sat through the night before, sobbing and stupidly glaring. And all day long he crouched by the fire shuddering, and all the night till 11 o'clock, and then a figure of his aunt came to him again, but always a little older and more withered. And this went on for 5 days. The figure that sat with him became older and older as the days ran, till on the 6th night he gazed through the hours at his aunt as she was on the night he killed her. On these nights he was used sometimes to start up and make for the street, swearing never to return, but always he would be dragged back to the eyes. The policemen came to know him from these night walks, and people began to notice his bad looks. These could not spring from grief, folks said, and so they thought he was leading a wild life. On the 7th night, there was a delay of about 5 minutes after the clock had rung 11, before the door opened, and then, merciful God, the body of a woman in grave clothes came into the room, as if borne by unseen men, and lay in the air across the writing desk, while the small drawer flew open of its own accord. Yes, there was the shroud and the brown scapular, the prim white cap, the hands folded on the shrunken breast. Gray from slimy horror, Gustav raised himself up and went over to look for the eyes. When he saw them pressed down with pennies, he reeled back and vomited into the grate, and blind and sick and loathing, he stumbled upstairs. But as he passed by Madame Jean's bedroom, the corpse came out to meet him, with the eyes closed and the pennies pressing them down. Then at last, reeking and dabbled with sweat, with his tongue lolling out and the spittle running down his beard, Gustav breathed. "Are you alive?" "No, no," wailed the thing, with a burst of awful weeping. "I have been dead many days."